from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. From the John Adams opera Nixon to China, to Jack White and the Outside Lands Festival.
I was in the shower, so I could not tell my nose was bleeding. Dripped down my body to the floor, right below my feet. Looked in the mirror of my face, I thought I had a disease.
There is a lot coming up this spring and summer in the San Francisco Bay Area, so next on Forum, we've called upon the KQED Do List team of Cy Musiker and David Wiegand to provide us with a full preview. We'll hear about what's coming up in classical music, theater, dance, pop music, and the visual arts. The Spring Summer Arts Do List Preview, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson.
It's a big job just getting by with nine kids and a wife. But I've been working, man, dang near all my life, and I'll keep on working. Long as my two hands are fit to use.
That's Merle Haggard, one of many performers who will fill up the Bay Area arts calendar over the next few months. And in this hour forum, we want to offer up a spring-summer arts preview. Joining us to do that, KQED's Cy Musiker and David Wiegand, the executive datebook editor at the San Francisco Chronicle. You hear them each Friday morning on KQED when they team up for The Do List, a kind of snapshot of the week ahead in the arts world. The Do List, by the way, always begins when Cy comes up with a clever phrase to introduce David. But Cy never
I'm the only one who thinks it's
never
clever.
Gets that treatment. So here we go. Joining us along with the Chronicle's David Wiegand, the maestro of the musiker, Siren Cy himself, KQED's Cy Musiker.
Good morning, David.
Happy to have you both here.
Thank
All right.
You.
Let's plunge right in now that I've done with that little bit of silliness and talk about something not silly at all, which is the revival, I guess, Cy, of the San Francisco opera Nixon in China.
Right. And this is the 40th anniversary of Nixon's trip to China in 1972. But this is about the opera, of course. We're talking about the music by John Adams, libretto by Alice Goodman, and the original production staged by Peter Sellers and Houston. But there was actually a concert version of it here done, I think, in Herb's Theater with John Adams himself at a synthesizer and keyboards that I attended. I remember just being amazed at the music and thought, really? Nixon in China as a subject for an opera? It was fabulous.
And let's listen to a little of it. Music from Nixon in China. And David, this actually first premiered 25 years ago in Houston, as I understand it, with David Glockley, who is now, of course, here.
That's right, yeah. So it's a very big deal that it's here in San Francisco with a full production. I don't think that there's any opera event of the year that's been awaited with greater anticipation than this.
And joining us now is the composer, John Adams. Mr. Adams, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
John Adams, Cy Musiker here, and I wanted to ask you about, take us back 25 years, when you first composed this music, how did you get past the common associations about Nixon, a very stiff personality, Watergate crook, a Cold War warrior who goes to communist China?
Well, it's funny to hear you say all those words, because by today's standards, Nixon is a liberal.
That's true. Well,
you know, I was keenly aware that you know, after Watergate, Nixon had become basically little more than the butt of late-night stand-up comics. But I also felt that the gesture of going to China at that time was really, a very bold and provocative one. And I also thought that the story itself, the idea of the collision of these two great ideologies, you know, capitalism, where you can put a price on everything and the marketplace is the god, and communism, where you know, there's this ideal that no one should go hungry or starve, but on the other hand, you have to have a tyranny to make it work. I thought that was one of the great themes of our time.
And John Adams, Dave Iverson here. When this restaging will take place, will it be different in any way from when it first debuted 25 years ago in Houston?
Well, you know, I'm unfamiliar with this production. This is not the Peter Sellers production that originated the piece. This is a production that David Gockley saw in Vancouver, and I really know nothing about it, so I assume it will be good.
And do you approach this with a high degree of anticipation after all this time?
Well, of course, I mean, Nixon in China, much to my amazement, especially given that it was my first opera and I truly didn't know what I was doing when I was composing it, it's turned out to be probably the most performed opera, you know, in the past 25 years or so, which amazes me. There was just a production this year in Paris and in Kansas City and two or three other cities. But I've long wanted it to perform here right in my own backyard. You know, I live in Berkeley. I composed it here. And as you mentioned, we gave a kind of workshop performance of it in 1987 at Herb's Theater. And I'll never forget that because it was just the singers with a couple of pianists. And even that event was mentioned on Tom Brokaw's NBC Nightly News. It was such a news event at the time.
John, it's David Wiegand. I'm curious about something. This is a wonderful opera, obviously, that speaks to every generation. What do you think that the message of Nixon in China will be to a current generation, a current audience, especially in the midst of our 21st century politics?
You know, the one question that I, as a composer, get that I absolutely cannot answer is you know. What is the message, or what should people take home? I mean, I can't give you a soundbite. You know, it's like most operas. It's a kind of overwhelming experience. When it goes right, it's unforgettable, mm-hmm. and when it goes wrong, there's nothing worse in the world than a bad opera.
It's unforgettable in a different way, maybe.
We will hope and expect that it will all go right when
Absolutely.
Nixon in China opens on June the 11th. John Adams, thanks very much for getting us started this morning. Let's turn now to another performance that's coming up, Cy, and that's when Michael Tilson Thomas will conduct the San Francisco Symphony in music very different than Nixon in China. This is about the oldest of San Franciscan music.
Right. Well, that's right. The MTT is going to conduct the San Francisco Symphony in Barbary Coast and beyond. It's got a colon in it, so you know it must be serious. It's music from the Gold Rush to the Panama Pacific Exhibition. And this is part of the symphony's 100th anniversary celebration, which I think David Wiegand has noted has gone on perhaps way too long. But wonderful capper to the season, really, in that they're looking back to the very first years that the symphony was performing and to music of the saloons and barrooms of San Francisco from 1849 on. And you get an idea of what an odd and potentially fun program this is when you realize that Val Diamond of Beach Blanket Babylon is narrating. You've got soprano Laura Claycomb, who's performed with the symphony a lot, but also United States Air Force Band of the Golden West and Carolyn McCaskey playing musical Saw. And there'll be sing-alongs to California.
And there's
Here
video and photographic projections.
That's
it's
right.
It's the full multimedia experience. Barbary Coast and Beyond, colon, as Cy notes, music from the Gold Rush to the Panama Pacific Exposition will be performed from May the 10th to May the 13th. And I don't know if this is part of the centennial or not, David Wiegand, but the New York Philharmonic is going to be here for the first time in many years.
It is part of the centennial. In fact, there are two other events. That's one of them that I wanted to mention relative to the centennial. Alan Gilbert will be here for performances with the New York Philharmonic. As you know, the symphony has had visiting orchestras from all over the country throughout the year to help celebrate its birthday. And the other thing that I would be remiss if I didn't mention is that on June 2nd, the Black and White Ball will happen in Civic Center. So with Paul Simon headlining with the orchestra.
And again, the New York Philharmonic will be at Dave Davies on May the 13th. Let's move to a couple of dance performance items. First, Ben Levy, which is a 10th anniversary gathering at the Z Space in San Francisco. David?
That's right. This is an extraordinary company, and this guy's really an inventive choreographer. Dance companies sort of come and go, and you get a sense, though, with some people that they really are making a difference in the dance scene, and that's certainly the feeling that I've always had from Ben's work.
And he's will be at the Z Space on May the 12th. That's
May 17th through 20th.
There's
a gala on the 12th.
The gala is the 12th?
I double-checked that. The performances are 17th through the 20th.
Yeah. Another longtime San Francisco choreographer, Cy Joe Good.
Yeah, Joe Good's got a new piece called When We Fall Apart with music by Ben Juo Davakis of the Avon indie band Battle Hooch, which is their local band, and a special set by an architect, Cass Calder Smith. And the great thing about Joe Good is he's so theatrical. I really respond to him because he tells a story. And this is a piece that's about our dreams of stability, marriage, home, and when those things work and when they don't work.
It seems to be something that could be really fascinating visually because it's not only dance, but as you said, he's working with an architect, and so there's a set that will kind of fall apart and be resilient and grow again.
Right. And he always thinks he's done pieces with marionettes. He did this wonderful piece a few years ago at the Old Mint in San Francisco where each room created its own sense of drama and expectations.
Joe Good. That's called When We Fall Apart. It will be at the Z Space in San Francisco from June the 14th to June the 30th. Let's move into the realm of visual arts, David, and something that's going to be at the Legion of Honor starting in mid-July, Man Ray and Lee Miller.
I know. This is absolutely fascinating. Man Ray's work is so amazing, and he and his assistant and slash lover, Lee Miller, created a wonderful body of work together and then separately as well. This will be 115 photographs, drawings, manuscripts that they've done. They worked in Paris for a very long time, and Man Ray himself was influenced by surrealism and Dada and, you know, that sort of thing. And it's amazing how timeless his work is.
I just learned that he was born Emmanuel Rednitsky.
That's right.
The 1890s, and the dates for the exhibit featuring Man Ray and Lee Miller's work at the Legion of Honor, July the 14th to October the 14th. Another one, Cy, is a photographic exhibit, Cindy Sherman at SF MoMA.
Right, and these are not self-portraits. Cindy Sherman is famous for creating these pictures that are of herself. But they're not self-portraits, very theatrical in a way. She puts on wigs and makeup and just the right clothes to become someone else. And I believe this is an exhibit that's being – it's the first time on the West Coast for a Cindy Sherman exhibit since 15 years or more. The last one was in Los Angeles. So it's a big deal for us to see her work now. She's getting a lot of attention, big auction prices in New York.
And joining us now to tell us more about it is Aaron O'Toole, who is SF MoMA's assistant curator for photography. Aaron O'Toole, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And as Cy was mentioning, this is what, the first retrospective of Cindy Sherman's work in 15 years? Is that right?
Yes. The last retrospective came to the West Coast but was only seen in Los Angeles. And so this will be the first time that her work has been seen in San Francisco in a large exhibition. So we're really excited about introducing her to a brand new audience.
Aaron, this is David Wiegand, and welcome. It's nice to talk to you, and I'm really looking forward to this exhibit myself. I'm curious about your thoughts about the sort of trajectory of Cindy Sherman's career. I mean, I think I'm old enough to remember that when people first started seeing her work, I think that they sort of thought it was a gimmick or something, and she's attained obviously immediate and lasting legitimacy in my mind. Do you think other people get that at this point?
Oh, yeah, I definitely think so. And I'm old enough to remember, too. As someone who, you know, came of age in the 80s and the 90s, I really understood her work, you know, in terms of the women's movement and and her questioning of traditional female roles that, you know, that went along with that. And, you know, she brought attention to the fact that these roles were were cultural constructions like those in film.
Mm.
And I'm really curious to see how changes in our culture and the advent of social media will change how people conceptualize what she's doing.
Give us some sense, if you would, Erin O'Toole, of an example of that. For someone coming to this exhibit, perhaps someone not familiar, as I am not, with her work, how does she do that? How does she call those things into question about contemporary society?
Well, as you said in the beginning of the of this piece, these are not self-portraits, but she uses herself to question our cultural constructions of identity and of norms. And she sort of, she makes them strange, you know, exaggerates them and calls attention to them and reveals the seams. You know, she's really interested in things like fashion or makeup and plastic surgery and kind of calling them out and demonstrating that that these things that we kind of take for granted are actually really weird. And I think in this, in the day of this period of social media, I think people are a little bit more comfortable with this idea that identity isn't fixed, and that that it's very slippery. And I think that our understanding of identity is much more fluid than it was in the 80s. And I think people will really relate to this work.
Erin O'Toole, SF MoMA's assistant curator for photography, describing the upcoming exhibit of Cindy Sherman's work. It'll be at SF MoMA from July the 14th to October the 7th. Erin O'Toole, thanks so much.
Thank you. I'm an avid KQED listener and a member, too.
Okay. It's the right time to say that sentence. Thank you. One other photo exhibit that you both wanted to bring to our attention, David and Cy, is Lee Friedlander at the Frankel Gallery in San Francisco.
That's right. He has another exhibit. I mean, this man is incredible and prolific, and this is called Mannequin. The last time they featured his work, it was extraordinary photographs from automobiles, and this time it features mannequins. And I've seen several of the photographs. They're extraordinary and provocative and just as beautiful as anything.
Right. I remember he's always been an inspirational photographer and a man who worked so quickly with a 35 millimeter camera, perhaps these days. I don't know if he's working with digital, but a very wonderful sense of the drama, of the opportunity for great catching amazing visualizations of street life, and he just had a better eye than almost anyone else.
It will be the Lee Friedlander exhibit will be at the Frankel Gallery in San Francisco starting yesterday and goes through June the 23rd. Let's move on to festivals. Big season, obviously, coming up this for music festivals in particular. And we're going to start with I guess the oldest, David. The Stern Grove is marking its 75th anniversary. This, of course, started with the gift that Rosalie Stern made to the city in honor of her husband, Sigmund.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the late 30s, started these series of concerts with the stipulation that they always be free.
And they continue to be free to this day. Not only are they free, but I'm always amazed at the quality of performers that they get, for every year. And obviously for the 75th anniversary, this is going to be a very special year. And not to give the symphony one more plug, but Michael Tilson Thomas himself will be conducting the symphony at Stern Grove this year. But, you know, there are many other performances that will be there.
SF Ballet is there, Al Jarreau and George Duke, Preservation Hall Jazz Band. I think they're annual.
Anita
Baker, Sheila and Peter Escovedo. It's really quite the and all free. It's sort of extraordinary.
Absolutely.
That could be true.
There used to be a tradition in town, that I have to say this, I'm paid to say this, that called the waving of the pink. And what would happen is that the opening performance of every festival, people would take the pink section and wave it in the air. And it still exists, so please bring your pink section.
Says David Wiegand, executive datebook editor. Another big festival coming up, Cy, is Outside Lands. Golden Gate Park starts in August the 10th through the 12th. Again, quite the collection of performers.
Yeah, it's a huge festival that seems to get bigger every year. Stevie Wonder is there this year, which is great, I think. Foo Fighters, Metallica, and I think we have some music to play, a little of something from Jack White.
Let's listen, Jack White.
I love to spin my mouth wide open and cover up my ears and never let me hear a sound. I want love to forget that you offended me or how you had defended me when everybody tore me down. Yeah, I want love to change my friend. all my fault. Yeah, I won't let love disrupt.
Jack White, that's Love Interruption. Influential performer who's been, I seem to read about Jack White with great frequency.
Well, he's amazing because he works, you know, on both sides of the recording studio. Cy and I were remembering, you know, just recently where he had done, he produced Wanda Jackson's most recent album, which is fantastic, and anything she does is great, but you can really feel his influence in the production.
Outside Lands also has this connection to environment and environmentalism. Is that something that, makes this festival particularly distinctive in any way, David?
Well, I think many of the festivals have to do that in this day and age. I mean, I think it's really important to have that message. For one thing, they probably couldn't get use of public land if they didn't do
too much trash. Yeah,
too much trash. So they really have to, emphasize the green aspect.
Outside Lands, Golden Gate Park, August 10th through the 12th.
Take public transportation.
Okay.
Yes,
there's your green message.
Right.
Couple more festivals we want to highlight. David, first, Frameline Film Festival, oldest and largest LGBT film festival anywhere there is.
That's right. It's the 36th annual festival, and it begins this year with the documentary about Vito Russo, who was an extraordinary activist and an important figure in LGBT culture. And it continues as a film featuring Olympia Dukakis and Brenda Fricker as a couple of elderly lesbians. Just the usual something for everybody.
June the 14th through the 24th. And we have time to mention one more festival before we come up on our break. And that's something I honestly wasn't familiar with. Probably should have been. The Kate Wolfe Festival in Laytonville, which honors the late folk singer Kate Wolfe.
So right. A wonderful singer and a wonderful event. It brings together a lot of folk and world music. Music groups up in Laytonville, which is a long, long drive because I've been there a few times. But Katie Lang is there. A Leftover Salmon, which will be good because the commercial salmon season is going to be good this year. Lucinda Williams is there. The California Honey Drop. So a great lineup of alternative music, a lot of acoustic music, and probably a very feel-good vibe.
Worth making that long journey for, David Wiegand?
I think so, absolutely. This is one of Northern California's most important festivals.
Kate Wolfe Festival, it's in Laytonville, June the 29th to July the 1st. When we come back, we're going to turn to the world of pop music and also the world of the theater. And give us a sort of one thing before we go to our break, David Wiegand, the theater show that you're the most looking forward to.
I'll just say two words, Murat Saad.
All right. We will talk about that. And tell us something that you're especially looking forward to.
I'm especially excited about Luis Alfaro's version of the Jason and Medea tragedy, Medea.
Okay. That'll be our topic when we come back. We'll talk about all of the theater that will be taking place in the Bay Area in the coming season. We're also going to talk about The Tempest and also The Great Divide, pop music. We're going to review who will be coming up, including Merle Haggard and The Roots and the 50th anniversary of The Beach Boys. Brian Wilson, now about to turn 70 years old. We'll talk about all of that when we come back with David Wiegand and Cy Musiker of The Do List as we continue our spring and summer arts preview. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. This is the hybrid Forum Do List combination for the hour as we preview what's happening in the Bay Area in terms of the performing and visual arts. We're turning now to theater and Endgame, which will be at ACT in San Francisco, the Samuel Beckett play. Give us a little background on this, sign, then we're going to talk to the lead actor, Bill Irwin.
Well, Endgame's a one act by Samuel Beckett, and like a lot of his plays, absurdist, bleak comedy about a blind man who can't stand, and his mother and father who are just heads in urns. It's a classic Beckett play because you think, huh? a lot of the time. And you always wonder where the possibilities are for comedy in something like that.
And Bill Irwin, now who plays the role of Ham in Endgame, joins us now. Irwin is a Tony Award winner, played for his role as George in the revival of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Mr. Irwin, thanks for joining us this morning.
Hi, good morning.
Happy to have you with us.
Yeah, and Bill, it's Cy Musiker speaking, and I wanted to ask you about this point about Samuel Beckett, that so many clowns are drawn to perform in his plays. You yourself have done a lot of clowning as well as some great work as a dramatic actor. Robin Williams was in a version of Waiting for Godot years and years ago. Bert Lahr did a version of Waiting for Godot on Broadway. What is it about these plays that draws the interests of great clowns?
Well, the attraction seems to go both ways. Clowns are drawn to the material because Beckett was drawn to clowns when he was writing this stuff. And I was listening to your synopsis of the play, absolutely dead on, except that I would say that we in the world have caught up to Beckett. He's not so abstract. He's not so far out anymore. He plays more like realism now. and the interesting thing, the reason these plays have lasted, you know, new playwrights, new writers, new artists are always doing jagged new work. It's sort of the young artist's job to get his or her voice heard. But most things fade into the sediment of history once they've kind of jangled the nerves and done that. The great plays stay on for some reason or other, and this play stays on and will stay on for generations. It feels an odd comparison, but I think it's really like Shakespeare. It's 300 years from now, they're going to be doing Endgame and Waiting for Godot. And one reason is Beckett looks at these huge questions. What is life? What is death? The kind of questions we tend to set aside just to get from appointment A to appointment B. But they're the huge questions of life. But he gets at them by means of absolutely true emotional exchanges between characters moment to moment. So, like I say, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which I had the thrill and the honor and the challenge to play a few years ago. Now, this play, they really are very similar moment to moment, and they're much less abstract than we tend to think of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're an actor's joy. And I have said, one doesn't like to make big claims, but I think they can be an audience's joy, too. The play is very, very funny.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Bill, it's David Wigand. You've done a lot of Beckett, and I think there's just nobody better than you doing Beckett. Is there a Beckett play you haven't done yet that is kind of, I don't want to use the word bucket list, but that you're really dying to do?
That's this one, Endgame. I put it off my list for a long time.
Really?
Saying to Carrie Perloff, I don't like that play. I love Waiting for Godot, or Godot, depending on how you pronounce it. The most recent production I was in with Nathan Lane and John Goodman and John Glover in New York, we decided to pronounce the title of that play and the character Godot, mostly because it made the jokes work better.
Oh, that's interesting. Interesting.
Yeah, so it sounds very pretentious it sounds very British to say Waiting for Godot, but actually all the jokes suddenly fall into line when you do that.
That's fascinating.
That's a play I've loved forever. Endgame, I kept saying, it's too abstract. That's his great masterpiece, and beware of great masterpieces. And now, to answer your question, this is the one on my list.
Uh-huh.
Why did you say you thought we'd caught up to it? What did you mean by that?
Well, when Beckett came on the scene in the 50s in France and a little later here in the United States, he's misunderstood. There's a famous production of Waiting for Godot, which they called the laugh riot of two centuries, like you're going to see a Boulevard comedy. and it is a deeply funny play, but it really confused the audiences in Miami, Florida, of all places, when it first played in the United States. But so then people say, I see what this is. This is high modernism. Okay. And as Carrie Perloff, directing this play, always says, the last thing you want to do is allow audiences to say, okay, I get what this is. I know where to take this, and now I don't need to listen. But it went from what seemed like high abstract modernism, a a resonant voice in the emptiness of the voice. To now, it just feels like me and my wife, any day of the week. And this is something that Nathan Lane used to say. He said, when I first read Waiting for Godot, I thought, oh, this is great stuff. It's modern. And now it just sounds like me and my partner.
Bill Irwin, he will be performing the role of Ham in Samuel Beckett's play Endgame at ACT in San Francisco. The run is from May the 9th to June the 3rd. Bill Irwin, thanks so much.
Gents, thank you very much. We'll see you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
David, let's talk, or Cy, whoever wants to take the lead on this next one, The Tempest, which is going to be, Bill Irwin mentioned that he thinks Beckett will live on like Shakespeare. So let's talk a little about a production of Shakespeare's The Tempest, which will be at Cal Shakespeare in Orinda. John Moscone is directing this.
That's right. John's directing, and it features some great Bay Area actors. James Carpenter and Michael Winters both will be in the production. And Erica Shook will be doing the choreography. It's a great play to open the Cal Shake season with.
Last year, they did an adaptation of Two Gentlemen of Verona, actually a brand new play called The Verona Project, which brought new elements and performance. Is that something that Cal Shakespeare is interested in sort of exploring more and producing these plays in different ways?
Well, I think John Moscone has taken every time he does a play in at Cal Shakes or wherever he works, he's great at taking apart why we care about it, why it matters, and finding something vital and fresh to say about it. And I am looking, I mean, they just did The Tempest, I think, 3 years ago at Cal Shakes. So I'm looking forward to this because I want to see how different this version will be. John Moscone always has such a touch. I think he brings out wonderful performances and just finds a fresh way of looking at the story it's telling. That's great. He's just been a masterful artistic director at Cal Shakes, and both you and I, Dave, enjoyed very much his show Ghostlight that he directed last year at Berkeley Rep, and before that up in Ashland, about his father, the death of his father, George Moscone. He's got so many things going on, and he's still finds fresh and exciting ways to do them.
The Tempest at Cal Shakes in Orinda. It'll be from May the 30th to June the 24th. Let's talk next about two plays that each of you are particularly excited about. First, something at Magic Theater in San Francisco, which is Bruja, a reimagining, Cy, of Euripides' Medea?
Exactly. Bruja is by Luis Alfaro, and this is the third time he's redreamed a Greek tragedy. That's the way Loretta Greco, who's directing this, artistic director at Magic Theater, describes it, redreaming it. He did Electra. He did a wonderful production called Oedipus El Rey. Was it last year or the year before? Set in a California state prison. And now Bruja, which is about this horrible tale of betrayal, you know, and loyalties forsaken. Jason, the Jason of the Argonauts, who goes after the Golden Fleece, is aided by this tribal chieftain's daughter, Medea, and he marries her, brings her back to Greece, and then things fall apart as he's tempted, because he's now a hero, he marries the king's daughter. And in Luis Alfaro's reimagining of this, it's a tale of also of broken promises and loyalty forsaken, but now it's about families as they emigrate to San Francisco from Michoacan. And as they assimilate, the way that fractures the traditional family structures, especially between husband and wife.
Bruja, Magic Theater in San Francisco. It begins on May the 24th, something that Cy is particularly looking forward to. David, for some reason, is looking forward to Murat Zat.
Well, you know, I think what intrigues me about this is just the courage that it's going to take to put this production on.
Yeah.
I don't think a lot of people have seen it. I mean, it hasn't, you know, hasn't been revived in several years. It was originally done by the Royal Shakespeare Company in the early 60s. It was at Lincoln Center. Then it was at the Martin Beck Theater. A young Glenda Jackson was in the cast at the time. It's about the murder of Marat by Charlotte Corday, but it's performed by a bunch of inmates of an asylum, and the Marquis de Sade is the director.
And let's listen to a little bit of the music from Marat Sade.
And the old king's execution. 4 years after, remember how those courtiers took their final bow.
And David, one more question about this. This is a modernized version of it. Is that right? It has, as I read Murat, as a laptop revolutionary.
Yeah, right. Everything is a laptop these days, you know. I mean, we were just talking about FWD last week on the Do List, which is about, you know, social media and so forth, too. This will be done by the Thrill Peddlers, and Scrumbly Coldwyn is the musical director, and it's at Brava Theater from July 11th through the 29th.
And let's mention one more, which is The Great Divide, Cy, at Shotgun Players in Berkeley.
Right. I just, real quickly, that this is based on Ibsen's Enemy of the People. Modernized.
Stephen McQueen movie.
Yeah. we don't want to remember. Think about the movie versions of that. A very exciting story, really, about a doctor in Norway who discovers a great public health hazard and then fights to uncover it, despite the fact that the government officials try to quash his investigation and the publicity.
And it's whole very contemporary question about where are your loyalties, what should you step forward to do, and all the rest.
Absolutely. And it's been modernized now with a female doctor in the role of Ibsen's doctor. And I believe the modern health hazard is radioactive something or other. And but it sounds like Ibsen can be kind of dreary. I think this is going to be a lot of fun.
The Great Divide, Shotgun Players in Berkeley, May the 16th to June the 17th. All right, time for pop music as we move towards the last part of our preview, our spring-summer arts preview with our Do List team. Cy, you're going to start us out with The Roots.
A great band. I have to say I have a very tenuous interest in hip-hop. This is a hip-hop band I can really play all day long. A hip-hop neo-soul band out of Philadelphia, very jazzy, very thoughtful, and really eclectic approach to how they present music with live instruments.
I guess if I was ever lucky, it was one time. Then I went missing, looking for the sublime. But it stayed low, left the ladder unclimbed. Time after time, verse blank, the lines unrhymed.
You ever wonder what's the big fuss for everyone to be on time? What's the big deal? Why do they feel the need to have this marching on line? Feeling unlucky, and if I ever got lucky one time, it's crazy.
I wonder when you die, do you hear harps and bagpipes?
The Roots, they'll be at the Regency Ballroom in San Francisco on May the 28th. They were described in what I read, Cy, as hip-hop slash neo-soul.
Yeah.
And you can hear that in that last part.
Absolutely. Well, sometimes there's a lot of singing on their songs. They don't fit into easy categories.
And the house band for Jimmy Kimmel.
That's right, which I think is great. And they've made some brilliant videos. You watch them on YouTube, really heartbreaking stuff.
Sorry, I said Jimmy Kimmel. It should have been Jimmy Fallon.
Thank you. Yeah,
let's go ways away from neo-soul and hip-hop to, David, the Beach Boys, 50th anniversary.
50th anniversary. I mean, that really makes me feel old, but, you know, everything does at this point. This is a reunited Beach Boys. The Beach Boys really have obviously had their ups and downs. When Carl Wilson died in 1998, that was really sort of the last time they were really together. So now they're coming back. Brian's with them, and they're celebrating their 50th anniversary. It's an exhausting tour. It's all over the country and then into Europe. But just to hear them, it's kind of amazing. You know, they were sort of dismissed in a way. They were just a pop band, you know, next to the Beatles and at that time in the 60s, and I remember. They have such legitimacy, and they're really kind of America's house band.
The Beach Boys, led by the 70-year-old Brian Wilson. They'll be at the Greek Theater in Berkeley on June the 1st. Merle Haggard, another person who has been around forever. He'll be at the Warfield in San Francisco. Let's listen to a little bit of him first.
Each night I leave the barroom when it's over, not feeling any pain at closing time. But tonight your memory found me much too sober. Couldn't drink enough to keep you off my mind.
Merle Haggard. He'll be at the Warfield Theater in San Francisco on May the 24th. Born in Bakersfield, I just learned. Yeah, I always think of him as, you know, the classic Hokey from Muskogee.
Right, oh,
the,
no.
Right, he's the other pioneer of the Bakersfield sound, along with Buck Owens.
Right.
Really rough tumbleweed contrast to the Nashville sound. And a very, very funny guy. A very dry humor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not at all. And the Hokey from Muskogee, I think it's something he believed at the time. But you hear him today. I think he apparently endorsed Hillary Clinton.
Merle Haggard again at the Warfield in San Francisco on May the 24th. Death Cab for Cutie with Magic Orchestra. Let's listen to a little bit of them as well, and then we'll talk about when you can see them.
Is sweet in the belly of the beast, in the belly of the beast, and with her song in your heart, it can never bring you down, it can never bring you down.
Death Cab for Cutie, performing along with Magic Orchestra. Death Cab for Cutie, alternative rock band from Bellingham, Washington. Magic, more of a San Francisco institution. What's special about seeing them together?
I think, you know, they're such a sweet sound. I think of them as a guilty pleasure, but they're a lot of fun. Death Cab for Cutie, incredibly popular, a lot of fun. And they're playing at the Fox for three nights. And as their backup, to sweeten the sound a little bit more, they've got the Magic Orchestra, which is this little classical ensemble based here in San Francisco, kind of under the radar. But they're highly in demand for especially for studio work, to bring strings into a orchestration. And they're touring with Death Cab for Cutie, I believe, and they're going to be at this show at the Fox. So it should be a really marvelous show, and three chances to see them, though the first two are sold out.
At the Fox Theater in Oakland from May the 8th through May the 10th, Death Cab for Cutie with the Magic Orchestra. All right, Natalie Merchant, another San Francisco Symphony event, David. We can't get away from the San Francisco
Well,
Symphony.
This is part of the Summer Symphony program, and Natalie Merchant is great. I actually had a chance to spend some time with her when she was doing a music workshop with kids at 826 Valencia a couple of years ago. And, I mean, she's just an extraordinary musician, extraordinary artist. I love her singing. She's amazing. She's absolutely amazing.
First came to fame with 10,000 Maniacs,
yeah.
Is that right?
Right. I think that's right. I actually think the most interesting thing about this is that during the whole of San Francisco Symphony's Pops shows this summer, they're going to be allowing people to live tweet from the upper balcony. So it'll be social media heaven for anybody who likes to do that during the performances. That'll be, again, just the upper balcony. And they can bring your cocktails in as well. So the opportunity there is for people to sort of loosen their tuxedos for the summer concerts and try to see how that works. I don't think they talk that over with MTT, though.
Natalie Merchant with the San Francisco Symphony on June the 18th. And one more, David. Symphony Hall event that I know you're looking forward to, David, and that's Idina Menzel.
Well, that's right. And what's really cool about Idina is that, you know, a lot of people now know her not from Wicked, which is where San Francisco first got to know her, but from Glee, because she had a long running story arc as Rachel's
mom.
Yeah. And it was great casting and a great role for her. She's going to be at the Symphony Hall on the 7th of June. But what's also true is that her co-star, Kristen Chenoweth, will be at Zellerbach Hall on the 11th. It's too bad they're not closer together. They could do a revival. But...
And she was also in Wicked, right?
Yes, she was.
She was the first Glinda.
Yeah. She was the first Glinda. And again, we saw her here when that show was on its way to Broadway, and it ran for about 4 or 5 hours, and got down to a more reasonable length before it hit New York.
And they both Idina Menzel and Kristen Chenoweth won Tonys for their roles in Wicked. I've got that down.
That may be true. Yeah. I take your word for it. Kristen at the moment is on a I think terrible TV show, but she's very good, called GCB on the ABC network.
Oh, even better, catch her in a brilliant new Funny or Die video as an interventionist singing about kicking crystal meth.
Kristen Chenoweth, it will be at the Zellerbach in Berkeley on May the 5th. Idina Menzel will be at Davies Symphony Hall in San Francisco. Both of them also starred in Wicked. So we want to thank our Do List team of David Wiegand and Cy Musiker, along with director Susie Racha, who bring the Do List to us every Friday, and every now and again on Forum, we give them a bit of extended time to give us their summer, spring and summer preview. Thanks both very much.
Thank you.
This is a fundraising period on KQED Public Radio. For more information, go to kqed.org/donate. I'm Dave Iverson. And continuing now with David and Cy, we're going to wrap up and talk about a few things that we haven't gotten to yet. One thing on the pop music front that we didn't get to yet, and I'd love to hear more about this. This is Barbara Cook, who's going to be at the Raz Room in San Francisco. Another Tony winner I have in my notes, and who is going to turn 85 years old this year.
You know, I mean, she's still going strong, obviously, but what's also true is that her voice is still extraordinary, and to have a chance to hear her sing is just, there's nothing like it in the world. She is the master mistress of the American songbook, just an extraordinary artist. And for hometown fans, she's also decided to get Mike Greensill to play piano for her, and that's not a bad thing either. Great combination. She'll be at the Raz Room from the 29th of May through June 10th. I think there are 12 different shows.
That's Barbara Cook, from May the 29th to June the 10th. One more item that we didn't get to in the first portion of our program that we should mention from the visual arts realm is the Nigerian art exhibit, which is called Central Nigeria Unmasked, Arts of the Benue River Valley. That's going to be at the Cantor.
That's right. It's at the Cantor Center. It looks really interesting. It specifically looks at that part of Nigeria. I don't know very much about it. One of the great things about the Cantor Center, of course, is that it's free. And they have really amazing exhibits down there.
It's a terrific museum.
Yeah,
it really is.
It's really great.
I agree. Central Nigeria Unmasked, Arts of the Benue River Valley, from May the 16th to October the 14th. In our last few minutes, I just would like to hear more from both of you about things that you're particularly looking forward to. We've had a great 50-plus minutes of discussion about all the things that are out there. It almost gets overwhelming. If people are wanting to sort of pick a priority in each of the categories that we talked about, unfair question, I know, but let's do it anyway. What are you most looking forward to in the classical musical realm first?
Well, I think classical music, I'd have to say right now, I'm looking forward to Marin Symphony, something we didn't mention
Oh, yeah, we didn't
early.
Talk about that. Yeah,
Marin Symphony
ahead.
Is doing a brand new piece called Chrysopoli, which is Greek for Golden Gate, and it's a piece about the Golden Gate Bridge by composer Rob Capello, who was commissioned by the Marin Symphony a year ago to do this piece. He's been interviewing people about their impressions of the bridge. He's been listening to the bridge, recording with going under the bridge, things like that. And then he's also enlisted in this effort, Prairie Home Companions' Fred Newman, to do live sound effects up on the stage. That's Sunday and Tuesday at the Marin Center in San Rafael. I have no idea what the music will be like, but it just sounds like a fun event in a year when the Golden Gate Bridge is such a hero of everybody's story.
Mm-hmm. And a particular classical performance that you're most looking forward to, David?
You know, actually, I want to talk about theater, if that's okay.
Yeah,
there are a couple of theater things that we didn't get a chance to mention that I am looking forward to. One is American Idiot, that's, of course, started at Berkeley Rep, and that's coming back to the Orpheum Theater now after its
Broadway run.
And the other thing is War Horse, which Carol Shorenstein is bringing in. War Horse was the play that she originally saw in London, became the Spielberg movie. But this is the play that I remember when she talking to her after she got back from seeing this play several years ago, and she said it was just like one of the greatest plays she'd ever seen. So they have added that to the SHN schedule, the production by the National Theatre of Great Britain, and that opens at the Curran on August 2nd.
I thought you were going to say the thing you were most looking forward to was the end of the centennial season of the San Francisco.
You know, it's my fault. They've done it. Yeah, he really overstates things. But, you know, it's either that or bad humor. What, you know, you have no choice. But no, I'm not. You know, I think the centennial has been absolutely wonderful, and this kind of something for everybody. But it just reminds us of the value of cultural institutions in the Bay Area. And the symphony has got a long track record, but there are several others like the ballet and the SF MoMA and the De Young that really, you know, these institutions last because we care about them.
And a festival pick, perhaps, from each of you. It takes a lot to go to a festival. You have to think about, okay, am I really up for this? Am I willing to deal with the traffic and the time?
Am I too old?
Right, exactly. So if you're looking at the festivals that stretch out over the spring and summer season, each of you pick one, if you would, the one that you really will make the effort to go see.
I probably would have to say Outside Lands. I mean, I, you know, this lineup this year is just so extraordinary that it just blows me away. And we didn't even get a chance to scratch the surface in the number of people they have there. Skrillex is going to be there, and I know that Cy really loves Skrillex and will definitely, you know, he is. Anyway.
I'm just going to go with the ones that are familiar to me: Stevie Wonder, Neil Young, Foo Fighters, Jack White. There's a lot. Yeah, and your festival choice?
Oh, I think I'm going to hold off and wait for Hardly Strictly Bluegrass in the fall, which is always worth it. That's the more music that I would make the trip all the way out to the outer part of Outside Lands of San Francisco for.
Cy Musiker, David Weekend, and Susie Racho. They bring us the Do List every Friday, and we're happy to have them on Foreign several times a year to give us their arts preview. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Christina Russo. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Dan Zoll is our senior editor, and Raul Ramirez is our executive producer. And this is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.